Well, well, well.
Oh, hello there.
Decided you have an accent for this episode? Are you going to stick with that? You going to stick with that, or are we going to?
I may. Okay. I might. Right. I don't know. Who knows?
See what happens. Let's see where this road takes us.
Bring it on.
Episode 3.
This week, we are actually speaking thematically.
Are we?
Yes, we've got a little bit of a triple negative breast cancer episode.
Do we?
And that is coinciding with Triple Negative Breast Cancer Day.
Yes.
Internationally, actually.
Oh.
So we thought it was a great opportunity to dive into this. And when I say we thought it was, I more mean like it was brought to our attention and we went, oh, wow.
That's a good idea.
We've got a breast cancer story, so really glad that someone told us.
Yeah, it's important that we don't. That the world doesn't think that we're capable of that level of foresight.
We're not doing our own marketing here, clearly. But look, so we have a thematic episode. I've already said that. but before we kick off with our triple negative breast cancer themed episode, Sean, I'd like to know, how's your week been?
Okay. This week, I started my return to work journey. I've been off work for, as you know, give or take, 6 months.
Yeah.
Probably less. Because of a mental health injury, which was sustained at work. I work in emergency services.
Yep.
So this week I've started the return to work process, which is, a bit overwhelming.
Congratulations, by the way.
Thank you.
Yeah.
The return to work is a non-operational return to work. So there's no frontline patient-facing work for me. Instead, one of the tasks I've been given is redesigning the slide deck.
Oh.
I'm told.
AKA
PowerPoint presentation for
those playing home. This is up your alley.
Yeah. No, I'm into it.
It is.
Yeah. It's for the induction for the new staff joining us in support roles.
Sure.
In non-operational roles.
Sure.
So I attended the most recent induction for these staff. As a part of that, you do the, welcome to the family. Who are you?
Yep.
What do you do? And I was the only person that had been in the organization for many time and it had moved from an operational role to a support office role. That meant, though, that when we started talking about things like, well-being programs and mental health initiatives for staff, there were a few people in the group that were really keen to hear my take on them. Curious to know what Sean thinks about these mental health initiatives, given his operational experience.
Fair enough.
Yeah. I hadn't expected, though, that I'd be talking to a group of strangers about mental health stuff in the realm of workplace injuries.
Yeah.
So I ended up going full hog.
Okay.
Yep. Full steam ahead.
Sure.
In for a penny, in for a pound.
Good.
Told everybody in the room about my whole story.
Yep.
And it was a little bit, if I'm honest, overwhelming. Room got a little flat.
Yeah.
If I'm honest.
Who invited this guy? A
lot of backpedaling from the group. Instantly.
Really psyched for my new job.
Instantly regretting asking this guy.
Look, we lol.
We do.
But I reckon that your organisation really just got a lot of value out of you, actually.
Yeah. I don't know if you can hear my voice. I hesitate to believe the same thing, but
and not just the organisation, but your colleagues, your soon to be colleagues or new, recently arrived colleagues. I think and we have some pretty frank mental health conversations here, but I feel like, the more that we do that, the more vulnerable we are, the more frank and real and just plain authentic we are about mental health in the same spirit that we try to be around our physical health, the better for everyone.
No, I could not agree more. And my personal experience with mental health problems is limited. I've had little to no issues, if you like.
Yeah.
When I started having problems, one of the things I Googled because I didn't understand was the word stigma. Google defines stigma as a mark of disgrace associated with a particular circumstance, quality, or person.
Mm.
So I am profoundly motivated to eliminate the mark of disgrace associated with mental health.
Yeah.
We should all be talking about it more often.
Yeah, totally agree.
Anywho, lighthearted start to the podcast.
Yeah.
How's your week?
Well, I have had a tough week, I think, in that I've tried to wrap my head around the fact that I'm finishing off one treatment and starting another one.
Yeah.
And in cancer land, that's always a little bit rocky because you have to let go of the one thing and you're sort of hanging in no man's land before we start the next. And I've had some pain, and pain generally in a metastatic cancer picture, in a, you know, spreading cancer, stage four cancer picture. When you've got pain, pain is bad. Pain is cancer, right? So I've had to deal with that, knowing that I'm in pain and it's still a week before I start my next round of treatment. Mm. So that has been a very rocky place for me mentally. And I've had some of, like, some moments where my sense of grief has been almost as intense as when I was first diagnosed with cancer. And we are coming up to the 5-year anniversary of that diagnosis. So there's a lot going on there for me at the moment. Mm-hmm. But one thing that I am really conscious of is that I use exercise as part of my cancer treatment.
Mm-hmm.
It's something we'll talk about on the podcast at one stage, I am sure. Mm. There's a lot of really good reasons to use exercise in cancer treatment. But just one of the really cool reasons is the kind of the endorphin rush you get, right? The positivity of just being active is in and of itself a good reason to exercise. I haven't been exercising, and I've really had to get my body to convince my brain to come to the gym, right? To work out. My mind has been just disinterested in doing any of that at the moment. And people who have followed me on Instagram or know me via, I don't know, some social media outlet will know that I use exercise a lot. So it's, you know, it's unusual for me to be so disinterested in exercise, but it's my brain saying it's too hard and we can't do it and there's too many things to try to conquer right now, mm-hmm. and we can't do it. So this week I have used exercise really under the instruction of my body. And with that in mind, I just sort of got on the treadmill and was like, right, I'm just going to pump out just a smooth 20 minutes of running.
Just a cool 20 minutes.
Just a cool 20 minutes. I haven't done that in literally 6 months, you know, and I've had a couple of surgeries to my chest, you know, a couple of ribs removed, a couple of rounds of chemotherapy. Haven't really done all that much running, more than about 5 minutes consistently, but that's fine. Let's just jump on board and let's just do 20 minutes. Let's just smash it out, see what happens.
Where did the 20 minute number come from?
I kind of see. So I always like go, okay, I'm just going to do 10 minutes. But in the back of my mind, I'm like, no, but really, I'll do 20. But really I was going to do 20. I don't know. It felt good.
Yeah.
I actually was like, oh, if I do 15, I'd be a champion and I'll be like my biggest fan ever. And then I do 20.
And then you did 20. Man, I'm not doing, I can't do that.
It was pretty slow.
Yeah. Sure.
You're still not doing, okay. All right. I get it.
Yeah. So let me ask you.
Yeah.
15 minutes would have felt like a champion.
Yeah.
How did 20 feel?
20 just felt like you should have seen me bopping around. I had a bit of head wobble about me.
Crushed it.
I crushed it.
Bravo.
Woo.
Look.
Yes. Enough about me.
I was trying to think of a polite way to say, look, I need to introduce somebody else now. Yeah. So
we're moving on from you and your patientness. It seems to monopolize the podcast every fortnight.
Oh, boy.
Moving right along.
No, can I just say thank you for sharing?
Oh, thanks. Yeah, no worries.
Well done.
No problem.
I'm proud of you. And thanks. I think I'm not the only one.
Thanks.
Let's have a chat to this week's patient.
Let's do it. Can we just let it be known now that we're recording that I do have a fractured rib and we need to accommodate me around that. It hurts and it's sore and I know Molly's in hospital, but I have a fractured rib.
It's got to bring it back to you. Though,
yeah, Marsha.
So now that we've, you know, I've got that off my chest, literally. All right. Well, Molly Clayton, welcome to the Inpatient Podcast. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself and how you became a patient?
I can indeed. So When I'm not hanging out in ED, I'm normally at home trying not to get COVID with my two daughters, Olivia, who just turned 2, and Alice, who's 4.5 months, and my husband, Nick. And when I'm not on maternity leave, I'm normally everyone's favourite person, a dentist. Yeah. It's generally avoided by the general public. And basically, to my dismay, I became a cancer patient a couple of months ago in October when my milk duct turned out to be triple negative breast cancer. So
okay.
Been a couple of months of 2 kids under 2 in a pandemic having chemo.
And when you're not that, you're a dentist. So, I mean.
Yeah. Yeah.
But the real question, the real question that I have here, which is probably the most serious question we could come up with, is can we show your face on TV?
Definitely blurred. Or just facing the back. Rob the dentist recommends.
good question. Second question, why are you in ED?
Look, I'm sure you appreciate this, but, you know, chemo, it's just a real roller coaster. Turns out getting a mosquito bite on a bushwalk can land you in ED 2 days later when your legs start swelling up. So,
wow.
I've literally sat at home for the last 3.5 months every single night with nothing to do because I'm trying not to get COVID and we have 2 young kids.
Mm-hmm.
And then the one night I'm supposed to be recording a podcast with you, I drive myself to ED 10 minutes before we start.
But you still made it here to the podcast.
I'm not trying to avoid you. I'm trying to prove that to you by doing the podcast.
We like to see ourselves as patient focused, and I'm glad that you were focused on us.
Yeah, so basically. Focused. So focused.
Okay, so let's take it back to the beginning of this cancer diagnosis. You talked about a milk duct. What happened?
So basically I was 38 weeks pregnant and I was having an elective Caesar. So I was booked in at 39. So it was a week before, and ironically at the time I was moisturising because I was worried about stretch marks, which feels very silly now to be worried about that, but everything's relative.
And
felt a funny little lump on my left breast when I was moisturising and a little patch of dry skin, and I kind of thought to myself that was a bit odd because I've never moisturized so much in my life as when I was pregnant, so it wouldn't be dry. So I felt like a little bit sick in the tummy for a minute and was like, well, that's not good. The lump just felt quite small but a little bit hard. So I did the conscientious thing and booked myself into my GP the next day.
Mm-hmm.
Luckily, I was on maternity leave, so I had time to do that. I think if I was working, I might not have done that.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, I went to her and wanted to get it checked, and she took one very quick look at it and said, you know, you're 39 weeks pregnant. It's a milk duct. You're 33 years old with no family history. Why would it be anything else?
Yep.
And I was like, oh, okay, just wanted to get it checked. And I get very awkward in situations sometimes when I'm nervous and I just make jokes. So I made some weird joke to her saying, oh, you know, I just didn't want to be that pregnant chick that thought it was a milk duct and it was breast cancer and she died and they talk about her on Current Affair or something. And she kind of looked at me and was like, what a strange thing to say. And then still she just, I said, do I need a mammogram, ultrasound? She's like, no, it's fine. Like if, and to her credit, she was like, you know, in a couple of months, if it's still there, you know, we can check it out. Yep. But, you know, it's a milk duct.
Yeah.
Like good luck next week.
Mm-hmm.
See you later. And so went in the next week, had the C-section, was in hospital for a week. Showed a couple of lactation consultants there, obstetrician, and no one was very interested in my story. And obviously at that time, Sean, I'm sure you'd appreciate this, breastfeeding. Boobs go up and down, change shape, texture. And so it was kind of hard to locate at times.
Mm-hmm.
And then went home and luckily took myself to an early childhood centre to weigh Alice at about when she was 2.5 weeks old. And I think, again, because I'm an oversharer and like the attention, I said to this midwife, I was like, oh, do you want to feel this lump on my boob?
Yeah.
While she was weighing my baby. She kind of looked at me and was like, sure, and had a feel of it and was like, you needed to get that ultrasounded yesterday. How long has that been there? And I said, oh, it'll be 5 weeks now, 6 weeks. And she was like, yeah, go straight away back to your GP.
Yep.
which I did actually because I had mastitis anyway. So I went, she felt it and suddenly looked wide-eyed and not as casual as she did the first time and sent me straight up the road for an ultrasound.
Yeah.
And then called me when we were out that night telling me the good news was it was a cyst, so not to worry, which I was pleased about. I did have a quick Google, but it said most of them are benign, so I went to bed and slept well that night.
Mm-hmm.
And then they said, you know, up to you if you want to get a biopsy, and I was like, why not? I'll get one. And so I went in the next Monday, a week later, to get a biopsy. And I got in there and the radiologist was like, why are we biopsying a cyst for you? You're breastfeeding. And I was like, is that a problem? He was like, well, it's going to get infected. You'll get a fistula and then you'll be just walking around leaking breast milk for the rest of your life. Like, it was really dramatic. Like, made me feel like I was going to be like Frankenstein walking around with milk shooting out on everyone at Coles or something. And I was like, well, what are my chances of that? And he said, probably 1 in 3. And I said, well, I'd probably rather know if I don't have cancer than have an infection.
Mm-hmm.
And he's kind of seemed annoyed and was like, fine, but I'm only doing a fine needle. I'm not doing a core. I was like, okay, sorry to inconvenience you.
So I just take you back one step? So you were asked, do you want to have a biopsy? And you sort of thought,
I was sitting in the biopsy appointment with the gown on and he was trying to tell me not to have a biopsy.
Yeah, well, yeah, that is true. But even originally when they sort of said, oh, do you want to have a biopsy or not? You know, like, what was your thinking in going, yeah, okay, I'll have a biopsy? Were you just thinking, well, an extra check is a good check? You know, what kind of led you to get the biopsy in the first place when it was kind of, is my understanding correct that it was kind of presented as an option?
Yeah, spot on there. Yeah, so I had basically Googled cysts and they'd said mine did look like what they call a complex cyst, mm-hmm. as opposed to a simple cyst. And that means there's different cell types and contents within this kind of blob that is a cyst.
Yeah.
So they do say, like, we do like to rule out that none of those cells are potentially cancer cells in a complex cyst. And I'd basically read that myself.
Sure.
While I was at the pub when she called me that night.
Just taking things
out. Where all research happens.
Yeah, totally. The best
That
research.
Was in the back of my mind. And the GP had said, when I talked to her, she was like, yeah, we do like to biopsy complex cysts.
Okay.
So she was pro-biopsy and she wanted me to have a core biopsy, which is what I should have had and didn't.
And so can you just explain the difference between the two of the
Yeah, so if you think of an apple, corer,
yep.
that's like a core biopsy. So it's a bit bigger, a bit aggressive. It takes a decent chunk of tissue out.
Yep.
And a fine needle is literally that. It's a very skinny needle that isn't as accurate for biopsies because it doesn't take a good chunk of tissue, which is what you need kind of to check for cancer properly.
Mm-hmm. And so taking us back to our radiologist friend who's just said you're going to have a fine needle and not a core.
Yeah. So I had the fine needle done and then that came back what they called inconclusive, but I had a read of it and because we do cancer stuff at work and I was like, well, that doesn't sound amazing. Yeah. And I went back and also he told me after my fine needle, he was like, that doesn't look exciting at all. I'm not expecting to see any. Like what I took out looks completely normal, blah, blah, blah. Like don't expect to hear from us.
He's told you that in the room?
Yeah, in the room, yeah. And so I went back and saw the same one the next Monday because TV was like, it's inconclusive, go back and have a core one done, the one that you should have had done in the first place. So I went back another week later and he seemed quite kind of surprised to see me and then a bit rattled and his hands were shaking as he went to do the other biopsy and I was like, this isn't good. He's rattled. And his assistant in the room was like, good luck with everything when I walked out.
Oh, wow.
And I was like, I hate that. And then we went to the GP 2 days later and they were supposed to be a telehealth and they called me. And I was stoked when I heard it was a telehealth. I was like, surely no one tells you you have cancer over telehealth. And they called me half an hour before the appointment and said, the GP wants you to come up and you should bring someone with you.
Oh, man.
And so, you know, we were pretty rattled, understandably, at that point. And then I saw her eyes fill with dread as she called me in for the waiting room. And then that was it. She told us then and we saw an oncologist the next morning.
And all of this happened recently, right? Like this was what?
Yeah, Alice is 4.5 months old. So I got diagnosed when she was 6 weeks old.
Wow.
So it took that 6 weeks, first 6 weeks of her life, I was kind of going back and forth between lots of these appointments. And that was the old diagnosis journey for me.
Wow. Where do you, like when you think about, there are obviously a few kind of mistakes, shall we call them, in your experience.
Bumps in the road, I'd say, yes.
Yeah. What's the number one mistake that you think happened in your diagnosis?
I think when someone presents with a lump, a new lump, it's supposed to be checked straight up. Is the standard of care.
Yep.
It should be. An ultrasound is painless and free. So it's not like you're sending someone for a full body radiation x-ray or like a brain biopsy. It's not an invasive test. It's not expensive to the system. It's not expensive to the patient.
Yep.
It's very quick. So I think that would probably be my major, because if that had happened then, I would have had a biopsy earlier.
Mm-hmm.
Everything would have been picked up quicker from that point.
That would have been with the GP.
Yeah. I think for me, I felt the worst about the interaction with the radiologist from a patient healthcare person. That interaction for me was the most negative one, just because I was felt like I was almost bullied out of getting a biopsy. So that's a real concerning point for me. But I think overall, that initial presentation where I was literally saying, do I have cancer? It's not like I was leaving it to her to say, well, cancer is a possibility. I literally walked in there being like, on my online booking, I put lump in breast, want to check if cancer. Like, I wasn't casual about it. I was quite direct that I was worried that it was cancer, but was dismissed anyway, despite numerous bad jokes aside in my appointment, numerous mentions of that primary concern for me.
Yeah. And when you, I guess, think about the fact that, I mean, you kind of raise mammogram, you know, should I get a mammogram or should I, you know, but obviously we don't, I mean, obvious now when we sit and think about it and talk about it in this format, but not obvious, and it wouldn't have been to you, me or anyone else at the time, but we don't mammogram people in that age group, right? In terms of screening.
Well, that's what she said to me. So I didn't know anything about it. She kind of made me feel a little bit silly at the time as well. In that first appointment, I was like, do I get a mammogram? She just kind of looked at me and was like, we don't mammogram people when they're 30.
Yeah.
And I was like, well, I didn't know that. Like,
but then we've created
Can I get one anyway?
Yeah, I want one, please. But we've created this circumstance, right, where we're not screening. We're asking patients to self-screen. They have done, and we're kind of turning away.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
On. And also, I wouldn't have said I was self-screening. I was moisturising with my fancy stretch mark oil. I wasn't. I was not meaning to find my cancer deliberately.
How are the stretch marks going? Just, you know.
But you know what? That's one thing that hasn't happened to me, but I'm about to get, you know, a chunk of that breast cut off. So I'm sure that's its own stretch mark in a couple of weeks.
There's good points, there's bad points.
Okay. No, stretch mark front, we're looking good.
Good.
Oh, thanks for that. We're looking good.
Good, good, good. There's always a glass half full when I'm in the conversation. Now, can we talk about then, you're having chemo, what happens next? Where is the plan? You just mentioned surgery. What else is sort of the treatment plan?
Yes, so on the plus side for me, I got shuffled very quickly through to see who I needed to see. I started on this great clinical trial probably 10 days, not even, after that first GP where she told us.
Yep.
I'd had a full health workup and was approved for this clinical trial within 10 days, I think.
Wow.
Which was pretty impressive. So it's called neoadjuvant treatment, which is just before surgery, chemotherapy and immunotherapy mixed together. And then I'm having surgery in a couple of weeks and then radiation therapy after that for a couple of weeks also. And then it's a couple of years anxious wait, I guess, assessing any new symptoms I get.
Yep.
And screening and hoping for the best.
Yep.
Can I ask, to what extent do you think that your, I guess, healthcare or medical literacy sort of had an impact on your outcome here?
I think it had a huge impact. I think if I wasn't in health and a pushy personality, I would be looking down the barrel of a very grave diagnosis at this point. In terms of triple negative goes really quickly from you just found it to it's everywhere. It's a very aggressive type of breast cancer, and mine, they said, was a very aggressive type of triple negative, so overall just a bad version. And I think, yeah, my health literacy and my, I guess you'd say, assertiveness definitely was the only reason I got a biopsy done, which is, yeah, if I'd waited until I'd stopped breastfeeding, which was that advice, I would probably be dead already.
Yep.
Or in a couple of months, which is terrifying.
It is absolutely terrifying. And if you think about that being, you know, the worst case scenario here, I mean, from your perspective, we talked about mistakes and we've talked about mistakes sitting with the GP and the radiologist. What's your take on, you know, performance improvement out of that mistake zone? You know, like what have we learned? What do you think that the GP has learned anything? Do you think that anyone's taken any kind of learnings?
I think both those two healthcare practitioners would now be screening and promoting biopsies for any lump they see in a younger female. I think they were both quite shocked. They both looked visibly shocked.
Yeah, but I guess what I worry about is that happens at an individual level for those two individuals. But what about all of their peers, all of their, you know, who should have been? I mean, we know that way too many people sit in front of a GP and get told, well, you're too young for cancer, obviously. And clearly you're not. So how do we
also
capture
my
that?
Beef, having read post this, is also the family history issue that almost, I think, four or five different, the sonographer, and I had an ultrasound, said it, the radiologist said it, the GP said it, they're like, but you don't have a family history. Triple negative is one of those cancers that is associated with the BRCA mutation that Angelina made famous for everyone. But only 15% of triple negative cancers are actually associated with that.
Yeah.
That was my next question. Yeah.
That leaves the overwhelming majority don't have a family history. So it shouldn't be that initial dismissal from GPs that I received, that some of the justification for that was that I don't have a family history, and the sonographer said the same thing. She's like, not in your family, right? And you're 33. So triple negative does affect younger women, and 85% of those cases don't have a family history. So I was confused why everyone was so baffled that it wasn't in my family when it's usually not.
Did you get any or have you pursued any reasoning as to why early they wouldn't pursue like a non-invasive, like an ultrasound or a, like, why was that not, is there any good reason not to do that?
Something that I think is one of the broken aspects of the healthcare system at this point, and I don't know what the motivation is there. I don't know if it's something sinister, like the GP is just busy and doesn't want to do it, or whether it's something less sinister, like they don't want to waste the patient's time, they don't want to send people for unnecessary testing. I don't know if it's like a not burdening the system by over-testing patients that they don't need to be. I'm not sure what the motivation for that is, you know, from their end. But I do think that's definitely a massive issue for me, since I've had now six ultrasounds. It takes 30 seconds. And it's not, I've had lots of painful things done, and that's not one of them. And mine was completely bulk billed through Medicare, all of them.
Yeah.
So it's not like an MRI where, you know, it's going to go cost you $700 to have one. I'm equally confused, Sean, there about.
I wonder if there's an element of this, you talk about the family history and that sort of question not affecting 85% of the people that might carry this diagnosis. I wonder if there's a sense of there's a belief that in the medical field that is the case, that, you don't have the history and therefore further testing is a waste of time. Like, I wonder if they just don't understand that statistic as well as they should.
Surely. Like, doctors are intelligent people.
Yeah.
Sure. I feel like that would be well known. Like, I've read it across, you know, Breast Cancer Australia, the Cancer Council website. Like, it's not hard to find that.
Yeah.
But I think also that those biases can just creep into our decision making every day.
Yeah,
right. Which is,
I agree.
Yeah, like why? And that's why I think we kind of go to this performance improvement kind of like, how do we learn from this? How do we actually make sure that this doesn't happen again? That there is only one, you know, they talk about sentinel events in healthcare, you know, like really things going really, really disastrously, really, really badly. Let's make sure that doesn't happen again. Well, this is an example of something that just, you know, just almost did.
I think it also is a bit of a trap was that I was pregnant. If I'd have walked in there not pregnant.
Yeah.
Or earlier in pregnancy.
Yeah.
I think that was a complicating factor in that initial dismissal from her was I was heavily pregnant.
It's so easy to explain.
I was a heifer. She just looked at me and was like, don't even get up off your chair. I don't even want to make you stand. Like it was at that stage of pregnancy.
We don't want obviously, the baby, please. You know, sit down.
Yeah, please. I don't want to deliver today. I think to be fair, that would have complicated things for her because,
absolutely.
You know, more often, most of the time, 99% it would have been a milk duct.
Yeah, but when we ask patients to screen themselves, then we have to listen.
Any new strange hard lump always deserves, I've since found out, its own triple check, I think is what it's called.
Wow. So. Now, can we just loop back to your current patient experience in hospital and the fact that you find yourself there? Why, just a bit of context, I guess, around why you have to go to hospital if you've got a mosquito bite when you're in chemo.
Yeah, so basically I have blood tests every Tuesday. I have chemo every Thursday and blood tests every Tuesday that check all my cell levels. And basically I'm what they call neutropenic at the moment, which means your neutrophils, which are a white blood cell that fight infection and things like that, are effectively non-existent for me. So they think maybe I got bitten by something that had the very tiniest bit of bacteria in it that would not bother anyone else.
Yep.
But you're in the slightest.
Sure.
Were you also, though, just trying to use a mosquito bite as a reason not to record a podcast?
Desperately.
Yeah.
Desperately.
It's a hard swing.
Funny, I've actually made it so far through this chemo without any dramas, and now mosquito bites send me down when I finish chemo next Thursday.
Yeah.
Oh,
wow.
Oh.
It's cruel.
That is cruel.
But you also get the experience, and I'm, as always, a glass half full person of, well, no, I'm sorry, there's nothing glass half full. Like,
look, it's been quite my experience this evening. I whisked me straight in and then didn't want me hanging around. Yep. There was a woman vomiting quite close to me in the waiting room, so they whisked me straight through, and I've got my own isolation room. So
that's great.
It's actually a very quiet place to make a phone call, so this is fun. I didn't have any of my notes or information or anything, so it's authentic as it comes.
This has been a very authentic patient conversation, and we are so grateful for it. Our last question, thinking about your experience of the health system, which is vast, obviously, because you are part of it as a dentist.
On both sides.
Yeah, your entire experience. What is your take on something that is broken, something that is working, and something that the entire system, everyone in the system, just needs to hear right now?
Oof, everyone in the system has been. I think what is broken is just that initial, I think part of the issue is that the dynamic between a patient and a healthcare provider, be that a dentist, be that a doctor, GP, nurse, radiologists, and I often think it's a perceived issue from the patients. Sometimes I experience at work where they think the power lies with the professional and it doesn't lie with the patient, when all the power should lie with the patient. In this day and age, it's your appointment, it's your health, it's your body, you know it better than anyone, you know why you've gone to see your GP. Like, I knew that, and I should have pushed harder on that first appointment in hindsight. I shouldn't have had to, but I should have. That funny skin next to that lump, the lump wasn't sore. I've had milk ducts in the past. I always knew something was wrong because it wasn't sore.
Yeah.
And but it's almost like people don't want to inconvenience the doctor. I have people at work telling me they don't want to waste my time. They don't want to hold up. They know there's people in the waiting room, and it's fine. It's your appointment. You know it better, and the doctors need to listen to that. All levels of the healthcare system need to listen to that. And patients, it should be a more friendly environment where patients feel comfortable advocating for themselves. I think it creates this atmosphere in the room when doctors are dismissive, they are condescending, they don't explain things in lay people's terms, that makes the patient feel inadequate. It doesn't make them comfortable. It doesn't make them at ease speaking about their own health when it's their appointment. I think that's my main take at the moment.
Amazing answer.
In terms of what's working, I think from when I got diagnosed and my biopsies too, my biopsies came back in 2 days. We were straight into the GP. That next morning she'd made us an appointment with an oncologist surgeon. He texted his friend, the oncologist, during my appointment and got me onto a clinical trial. I had imaging done 2 days after that, full workup, and was straight into a clinical trial for which we haven't paid a cent, all within the space of like a week. I just moved so fast. Everyone was so great. Everyone just did everything for us. And the care has been amazing. I've been all through the public system for the clinical trial and we've had best nurses, best care. It's generally been free treatment at this stage for me and just amazing levels of facilities, care and stuff. Something that I think everyone needs to hear right now is just that patients know their own bodies, but they need to have a space where they feel comfortable speaking about that, where they're educated to know what to look for in terms of their own health. And then once they're in that situation where they are speaking about their own health, they need to be in an atmosphere that allows them to advocate for that and to explain that and for that to actually be heard and for that to translate into the appropriate testing.
Yeah.
With no biases, with no horses instead of zebra situation, with no milk duct instead of cancers issues, you know, with no anemia instead of bowel cancer problems, like Adam in episode one. It's just, just an atmosphere for listening and an atmosphere for talking.
Yeah. And that's, I think the way that you describe that really describes a relationship between doctor and patient, right? Between, particularly between GP and patient.
Yeah.
That's a two-way thing.
For sure. Yeah. And yes, patients need to be, you know, taught about things like screening and, you know, going speaking, but not everyone's an outgoing personality. Some people have a huge amount of anxiety when they go to medical appointments, medical appointments. I see that at the dentist. Everyone hates us. People come in sweating. They come in crying.
Completely.
And then they can't remember why they're there. And sometimes I have to be like, you wrote on your appointment note you wanted to talk about this today. Did you want to talk about that? And I have to really drag it out of them, the reason that they made their dental appointment.
But that's what I'm, I guess that's what I mean about the relationship, right? Is that, you know, like it's just, it's such a complex thing to be a patient. And when you're sitting at home in your own space, you know what your problems are. But then when you go into a different foreign environment with potentially a complete stranger, it's a really difficult thing to do. And so it takes a little bit of give and take to get that right and to feel like you can have a conversation.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And when there's easy tests to do, just do easy tests. Do them. Like I was talking about adding cancer markers when you've got some, you know, strained, unexplained anemia or something as simple as that.
Yeah.
It's just,
and
in hindsight, the ultrasound, like why?
Yeah, that one.
That's such a good question you asked, Sean. Like,
that really confuses me. I mean, I granted I'm very lay and very green in this space, but yeah, I don't understand that. And look, I know Nicole said she's asked you a last question, but I do have one more for you. Do you blame your GP?
No. No, I actually don't. I'm still seeing her. I see her every couple of weeks. Same GP.
Okay.
To her credit, she didn't dismiss me and say, have a nice life. She was kind of like, you know, if it doesn't go away, maybe come back. But, you know, I definitely, I still see fault in that appointment for sure. But, you know, I kind of like going back because I like reminding her about me every time. I find my husband first couple of times being like, you know, she looks like she feels sick every time she sees me in the waiting room, but I want that. I want to keep going back.
We've like, learned a lot about you today, Molly.
I'm hopping my face up again for you to say hi.
Just a huge game of I told you so.
Look, thank you so much, Molly. I just cannot express with enough thanks how grateful we are that you continue to speak to us tonight. You kept your podcasting appointment despite your hospital admission.
Thank you.
And
commitment.
Yeah, massive commitment for, you know, yes, thank you on behalf of the Inpatient Podcast and all patients and all listeners. But can I also just say, you know, what an experience, and just your honesty in sharing it. Yeah, we're just very, very, very grateful, particularly because you're so in it, you know, you are living this diagnosis and this treatment pathway and all the complications that go with it. And so thank you for being so open in sharing that with us.
No, it's an absolute pleasure. I guess I'm early on, but I do feel guilty some days. I haven't done anything with my cancer diagnosis to better the community like everyone else, like yourself. Make people feel like a lazy cancer patient. So I'm glad I could do at least the smallest thing by chatting to you for half an hour.
Positive reframing, right? This is what we're doing now. This is what Sean keeps teaching me, positive reframing.
I learned it recently. Apparently it's a thing.
It's a thing.
Yeah.
Awesome. Amazing. Thank you.
Thanks, guys. An absolute pleasure.
Thank you so much, Molly.
All right. So just want to acknowledge the fact that, you know, Molly's family were trying to reach out to her and get in contact with her while we were monopolising her time in the ED. For that, we apologise.
I don't, yeah, profusely, because I could only imagine if you had checked into ED trying to call you going, hey, what's up?
But it would be totally like me to be like, guys, I can't talk right now. I'm on a podcast. Like, I've committed to this and I'm doing this. What is your problem? So we've spoken to a patient.
Yes.
It's time to speak to the system.
It is.
We wanted to go in the direction of advocacy this week.
Mm-hmm.
We really wanted to acknowledge that triple negative breast cancer is something that our community, our population, our health system has to deal with.
Mm.
And we wanted to speak to a group who are going to have the patient's point of view in mind as we have that discussion. So we went to Sarah Powell, the CEO of Pink Hope, and she very graciously accepted our invitation.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Could you tell us a little bit about yourself, Sarah, and also Pink Hope as an organisation?
Yeah, absolutely. So 16 years ago when I was 29 years old, I was diagnosed with breast cancer and triple negative breast cancer. And back then, the BRCA, you know, genetic mutations were relatively new. And so because I said I didn't have a family history, they didn't offer me genetic testing.
Right.
So I went on and had all my treatment. I actually froze embryos because I was told that chemo would affect my fertility, but they lied and I fell pregnant weeks after finishing treatment. So a nice ending to a not-so-good year, wow. I guess.
Yes.
And I think it was just, perhaps it's a mother's instinct, but when my daughter was about 6 months old, it didn't sit right with me that I was so young to get breast cancer. So I did a bit of investigation myself and found out that people with Ashkenazi Jewish ancestry often get BRCA mutations in a much sort of, it's much more prevalent, I guess, in those communities. And so I went to Peter Mack in Melbourne and said, look, I do have Jewish ancestry, and Ashkenazi Jewish ancestry is just Eastern European Jewish people.
Mm-hmm.
And so my grandmother was from Lithuania. And once I told them that and that I'd had triple negative breast cancer, they just said, yeah, you need to come in and chat with us.
Yep.
Sent me off for testing. Back then, it took 4 months to get a result. Which seems quite funny now because they can get results pretty quickly these days.
Yeah.
And they called me after 2.5 months and said, you need to come in. And, you know, I knew then. I thought, well, that can't be good. They called me. And sure enough, I had BRCA1 mutation. So this is the one that was by Angelina Jolie. And I'm so glad that she came out with it, because now I don't have to explain to people what it is. And so I just...
Angelina Jolie.
I joke, if I had to share anything with Angelina, I wish it could have been Brad. Not. but there you go. That's what I'm sharing with her. So back then, 16 years ago, or probably it was probably more around about 13 or 14 years ago, once I had the genetic test, I Googled and I found Pink Hope. And very much in its infancy back then, wasn't a registered charity until actually 10 years ago. But I found this community of women that really understood what I was going through. Because when I had my mastectomy, my friends just thought I was having a boo job. And I think it's the only thing that they can really understand, I suppose, or comprehend, but it, you know, it's really not having a boob job. And so, you know, Pink Hope, it was just life-changing for me. And the friends I've made through Pink Hope are still my friends today. So it's really amazing. And so I became very involved in the charity and became really good friends with our founder, Crystal Barter, who founded Pink Hope. And I think it was in August in 2020, so just after COVID had just hit, she called me and said, look, I'm ready to step down as the CEO. Would you like to take over? And I was like, hell yeah. So, you know, I'd always talked about working for Pink Hope, but then it was very much a Sydney-based charity. And it probably still is a lot because I do spend a lot of time in Sydney. But, you know, the silver lining to COVID is we can work anywhere. So that sort of barrier was removed. And so, yeah, so I took over as CEO. So that's a very long-winded way of me telling you how I ended up here.
There's something that strikes me when I look at the Pink Hope website is that it does talk a lot about, I guess, risk of breast cancer and prevention of breast cancer. And when we listen to Molly's story, she obviously had an experience where she kind of almost stumbled across her and sort of self-screened her way into a conversation with her GP about a possible breast cancer, but then it was kind of missed. You know, that opportunity to diagnose at that point was missed. And I'm wondering if we could get your take on, you know, just how often that happens as someone who represents, I guess, a collective of patient experiences in this space.
So it happens all too often, and we get many, many phone calls and emails from women that say they've been to their doctor and their doctor's just not taking them, well, not taking them seriously, but doesn't listen and understand what it means to be at high risk of cancer. And we got an email recently from a woman who went to see her GP, had a very clear family history of breast cancer, and her GP said, well, you're too young to get cancer. And she was maybe late 20s. So, you know, that just shouldn't happen. But unfortunately, GPs are expected to know everything about everything. And it's hard if they don't come across this, particularly in rural settings where we know GPs are stretched even further. It's really tough. And I, you know, something that we are really, really concentrating on this year at Pink Hope is educating healthcare professionals. So that no woman ever goes to their doctor and isn't listened to and understood.
Now, Sarah, we are aware that there is a bit of a global light that's being shone on triple negative breast cancer this week. Can you take us through just a high level, I guess, introduction and understanding as to what triple negative breast cancer is and what makes it distinct from other breast cancers?
Yeah, absolutely. So generally when you get breast cancer, they will test the tumour for three markers. So estrogen, progesterone, and it's a protein. It's the HER2 protein. So they're looking for those three markers on your cancer. And basically, are any of those sort of causing your cancer to grow? Now, if you're triple negative, you're negative to all three of those. So when someone has a hormone positive cancer, then they're generally positive to either one of the estrogen, progesterone, or both. If you have got an HER2 positive cancer, the reason they like to know that is because there's an amazing drug that was listed on the PBS a few years ago called Herceptin. It's really effective for women that have that type of breast cancer. So they're looking for all three of these markers because if you've got a hormone positive cancer, there are there's hormone therapy basically that will, once you've had your chemotherapy and your radiation, which is generic still these days. You know, chemotherapy, it just basically smashes every cell in your body as well as the cancer. But these hormone therapies are a little bit more targeted towards these type of cancers. So it sort of gives you hope at the end of your cancer sort of treatment that you're doing something to prevent your cancer. And it's something I found so hard at the end of my treatment. I walked out of my last radiation appointment and just cried because I was like, well, what am I doing now? What's going to stop this cancer coming back? So with triple negative, it's chemotherapy, radiation, and then that's it. Let's hope for the best. And with triple negative breast cancer, they tend to be higher grade tumours, like Molly and I both had. Molly said she had a very high grade. I assume it was a grade 3 as well, mm-hmm. which means it's growing really fast. That's basically what the grade is telling you. And so it can spread really, really quickly.
Yeah.
And they say that your risk of a relapse is the highest in the first 5 years after your diagnosis, which is why my oncologist told me not to get pregnant in that 5 years.
Mm.
And, you know, for me, I was very lucky and it turned out okay. Actually, I remember when I found out I was pregnant, I felt like a teenager going to tell their dad they were pregnant. And I walked into my oncologist's office and I was like, oh, I'm pregnant. And he just said, oh, it'll be fine. You know, he said, well, it is what it is, you know, we'll deal with it. He was just worried that I'd either be pregnant or having a small baby and might need more treatment again. So, you know, that was his concern. And luckily for me, I found my tumour very early. So it is different because those first 5 years are really stressful. And after 5 years, you know, there are people that would get a recurrence or it might have metastasized after that point, but it's quite rare. And with hormone positive cancers, you know, I had a friend that was fine for 12 years and then it spread to her liver. So it's just different.
Different. Yep. Yep. One of the things that you have mentioned already is the importance of educating health professionals, and you've noted that that's something that Pink Hope is putting some work into this year. I'm really interested to hear, I guess, a little bit of a commentary from you as to what it's like to try to get airtime with health professionals and if they're listening to patient groups who do represent such a collective patient experience, particularly because we know it is so difficult for individuals necessarily to have a voice and to feel confident and comfortable about speaking. Do you think you have the ear of health professionals, and how is that work going?
Look, that's quite a big term, right? And I can say that all of the healthcare professionals that we work with are listening.
Yep.
And they very much support our mission. They encourage second opinions, third opinions, whatever you need to do. They encourage you coming with a list of questions. They want you to understand, read up if you have to, use reputable sites, don't just Google, you know. But they really encourage that, and we would only work with people like. The problem is you can't talk to every healthcare professional, but we actually had a bit of a team chat today, and we're doing some metastatic focus groups at the moment to find out what's missing, you know, what is missing from patient support groups, but also what's missing from your healthcare professionals.
Yeah.
And, you know, we were sort of talking, we decided we want to get some healthcare professionals and talk to them about it to you know, get a balanced view. So, you know, how do they think they're doing in this space? But, you know, one of the things I think we need to do is we need a few champions out there that will take it to their colleagues, you know. I think that's and it is going to be the easiest way. And I just think if you can provide some easy to access information, and it's interesting, we often get phone calls from doctors and healthcare professionals asking us for resources, which is great, you know, and we totally encourage that if they want to learn and understand more. But it's a two-prong attack. Mm-hmm. I think we have to educate the patients and empower them and educate the healthcare professionals. But the problem with educating patients is, well, first of all, you can't just tell people what to do because that isn't helpful. So we try and create lots of resources. You know, here's a list of questions, print it out, take it to your doctor. Here's, you know, a nice short video, sort of some things you might want to consider. But, you know, you can educate and empower the most confident person, but when you're sitting in front of a doctor being told you've got cancer, sometimes that stuff just goes right out your head.
Mm-hmm.
Another area that we really want to work on is carers and you know, how carers can support patients through this by asking the questions and supporting them and making sure that they're being listened to.
Yeah. Molly spoke about this idea of the power in the room, the power in the dynamic between doctor and patient, really sitting with the doctor. And that's sort of something that's resonating as well as you're having this conversation. What You know, bearing in mind that there is so much to take on in a cancer diagnosis and for a patient, it is a pretty burdensome time. You know, what can be done, do you think, to address this sort of power imbalance and this tendency for a patient to feel like they're not necessarily really empowered to have a conversation with a healthcare professional?
Look, one of the things we always encourage is get a second opinion. If you go and see a doctor and you don't think they're listening to you or they understand, then find another one. You know, I often use the analogy, if you're buying a car, you'd probably go and see more than one. You know, it's okay to say, oh, I'm going to get a second opinion. And it's not about shopping around, you know, finding someone that's going to tell you what you want to hear, but it's about making sure that you've got a relationship with that person and you feel confident that they're on your side. So we had a lovely woman call us this week on our phone line and spoke to Lisa, who's my colleague, and she was in tears. She was really, really upset because she was booked in to have her ovaries removed. She has a BRCA2 mutation. And her doctor just didn't really understand anything. Had been telling her for a long time she didn't need to do it. You know, really just kind of put her off doing it. She's 42. And didn't really tell her whether HRT would be okay, just really didn't understand. But then at the last minute said, oh, I spoke to another patient who had a BRCA mutation and got ovarian cancer, so yeah, I think you should do it now. And I mean, that doesn't really fill you with confidence that they had to speak to another patient to say, yeah, you should be doing this. And so Lisa spoke to her for a very long time and sent her lots of resources and information. And after that, she chose to cancel her surgery, booked in with another surgeon who's, you know, spoke to her GP who found her a surgeon that understands BRCA, actually ended up being the same surgeon I used in Melbourne.
Oh, wow.
And so then I gave her a call a couple of days later to see how she was going, and she, you know, she was feeling a lot better, but she shouldn't have to have that experience, you know. It's just not good enough, and it's that doctor didn't feel they knew enough, then they should go away and find out about it, you know, and give that person, or say, I'm going to refer you to someone else who's better equipped to help you with this. But, you know, it's hard for some people. She was feeling quite overwhelmed. She has young children, you know, so sometimes the thought of having to book another appointment can be quite off-putting, but it's really the only way. It's okay if you don't get on with a doctor. I did not get on with my oncologist.
Yes.
And he when I tell people who he is, people are like, oh, you're so lucky, he's, you know, the best. But he would have been great with an older person with breast cancer. He just did not understand a 29-year-old with breast cancer that had completely different concerns. And at the end of my chemotherapy, I said to my breast surgeon, do I have to keep seeing him? And she said, you can just do your, you know, your checkups with me. And that's what I did. But see, you know, I'm confident enough to do that, but yes, some people might not be. And that's hard.
Yeah. And that is that power dynamic. I think that is such a tricky thing for some people to even have the confidence to acknowledge, let alone navigate.
Absolutely.
One of the things that I've heard sort of said before is this concept that, you know, patient organizations, patient advocates in general are symptomatic of a health system that's not really working, because if the system advocated itself for patients the way that it should, we wouldn't necessarily need advocates and patient organizations to kind of do the bidding of patients, because the system isn't working, if you like. And I'm interested to sort of get your take on that and your perspective on that point of view.
So we represent the patient voice. And so, you know, and we don't, it's, I mean, obviously advocacy is a big part of what we do, but it's the support and connection. I'm not sure how the healthcare system would be able to do that.
Yeah.
They come in, you know, unfortunately they come in from a very different perspective. So I think there's always going to be a place for patient advocacy groups, but the healthcare system can definitely do a lot better.
Yeah.
I just think they need to work more collaboratively with us, so that the patient voice is really, truly heard.
Yeah.
You know, I know that there's some universities that actually bring patients in when they're training their doctors, talk about how they want to be treated, you know, and what's important to them and that kind of thing. I think that should just be standard on any medical training that's done.
Completely.
And that would be a great way to start to bring it in, so that you know, so it becomes real to these doctors. These, you know, these are real people with real lives and yeah. real concerns.
Yeah. And just to normalize that conversation, I think, right up front in the journey as a healthcare professional, I guess.
Yeah, exactly.
Also just, I guess, broadly interested in your perspective on, you know, we are trying to look for that collaboration and growth and improvement in our healthcare system, but it is a very slow-moving beast of a healthcare system, and you've experienced it yourself as well, personally, as a patient. What, you know, what are the opportunities that we have? Are there any sort of low-hanging fruit, as it were, for further collaboration, more patient voice, a broader understanding of the patient experience, kind of all of the above?
Oh, I mean, there's so much work to do. It's funny, actually, I've just taken someone on new at Peak Hope, and she's really gung-ho, and she just is like, I want to do this, 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 and this. And I was like, okay. When I started Peak Hope, I was exactly the same. And then I've become incredibly overwhelmed by this long list of things that I'm thinking, because we're a small team. You know, we are a smaller charity. And I think something I'm really focused on this year is collaborating with other patient organisations because I see so many of resources, we're doing the same thing.
Yes.
Yeah, I think that if we can all start working together to try and make change, we'll have a much bigger voice to do that.
Completely agree. It resonates so much. You know, as someone sitting here with a stage 4 bowel cancer, you know, and just knowing that so much of the important work that you're doing in advocacy, in getting, you know, airtime with health professionals, and, you know, I've often thought, why can't we have a sort of a top 10, you know, issues for patients to be aware of at the GP, and they don't need to be classified, you know, under pink ribbons or green ribbons or blue ribbons. They could just be a collective experience of issues that we need to look for. And I think it's just so refreshing and really exciting to hear a patient organization committed to that, you know, for all patients and not just an individual stream of patient experiences, if you like.
Yeah, and actually last year we worked on a campaign called New Normal, Same Cancer with, I think there was about 9 or 10 patient organisations who worked on this campaign because of, you know, obviously the alarming data, I suppose, that shows that there's such a decline in cancer diagnosis because of COVID, people not presenting for their usual checks or not going to the doctor when they needed to get something checked. And it was just amazing to collaborate with so many other patient organisations. I think it's more powerful even to patients as well. You know, it's much more credibility when you can see all of these organisations saying, you know, this is a really important message. So it's definitely something we're committed to.
Yeah.
Sarah, one of the alarming things that came for me out of Molly's story was what I guess is hesitancy for a medical professional to even engage in the most non-invasive of tests on the presentation of a brand new lump. I'm interested to hear your thoughts on what, you know, what might cause is it just bias, or like, why aren't we doing these easy to do tests on new lumps where they present?
I think you don't generally see people with breast cancer as young as Molly. It does happen. And being pregnant obviously just added to the whole, well, it's obviously just a boxed milk duct or something like that, you know. So they sort of looked at her age, no family history, you know. So I think obviously they just made some assumptions, which they shouldn't have. And I'm not making excuses by any means, but, you know, it sounds to me that that's what happened. And it's just lucky that Molly was confident and educated and, you know, health literate enough to say, no, I'm just going to keep pushing here. And what really struck me with her story is that she did all this when she had a newborn.
Totally.
You know, like, I didn't leave the house. Yeah. You know? So she's running around trying to get tests. So she's so superhuman.
Yeah.
So she's really lucky. And because, yeah, triple negative breast cancer, you just, the longer you leave it, you know, your risk of it spreading is it just gets higher and higher. So, yeah. You know, lucky for Molly, her story has, you know, at least, you know, her cancer's been found early. I don't know. There isn't really any excuses for it, but I assume that was their decision process when they, you know, kind of tried to put her off having any testing.
Sure. Yeah. And I think that there also is, you know, we've acknowledged already a little bit of a health economics angle to things, you know, and are we over screening and are we over testing and what's the net benefit of doing so? You know, I know that I hear that again and again in advocacy circles from clinicians who aren't the ones who end up with the cancer generally, but so it works.
Exactly. Mm. Yes, it does frustrate me. We actually have one of the women who I've just is just started working with. She was getting quite sick and had her implants removed, but it took her a long time because she's had a mastectomy. It took her a really long time to find a doctor that would actually remove them. And one doctor said to her, male, so sorry, Sean, but said, excuse me, he said to her, he used a really awful expression, like he said she wouldn't be aesthetically pleasing if she removed her implants.
Oh.
Yeah. So, you know, some of the things that we hear that doctors say, it's just, yeah, just not good enough. Wow. But
unbelievable.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, amazing. I just thank you so much, Sarah, for I think sharing both your personal experience of breast cancer, but then professionally what you have committed to and continue to advocate for in terms of patient representation and elevating the patient voice and patient experience. We are so grateful that you could join us today and just give a little bit more perspective and light on Molly's experience. Thank you, Sarah, and thank you, Pink Hope, for joining the Inpatient podcast today.
Thank you so much, Nicole and Sean, and you guys are an inspiration. Everything you do is just amazing. So it was an absolute pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Sarah. My biggest takeaway.
Mm-hmm.
Test the lump.
Just test the lump.
Would you please just test the lump?
Call out to all doctors doing testy stuff. How about you know, do it.
Test the lump, man.
And I think that the thing that resonates with me as a cancer patient again and again is that there are so many people out there who've got the role of thinking about health economics.
Mm.
There are very few people who've got the role and then the associated ability to actually do something clinically, right? Mm. They make it pretty hard to be a doctor.
Yeah.
You have to get some pretty high marks. They kind of shut the doors. They don't really want a big volume of people in there doing medicine.
It's one of the harder things.
So therefore, if you're in that seat, if you've got that hat, we need you to do it. We need you to test the lump.
And on that point.
Yep.
I have heard doctors say, I'm just a foot soldier.
Mm-hmm.
When, you know, at the GP level particularly, you are the gateway.
Yep.
You are the bridge to, no. The bridge across, no.
The gatekeeper? The gatekeeper.
You are the keeper of the gate.
Yeah.
To all other treatment pathways. Yeah.
But and not just in this particular instance of whatever that lump may be, but actually for someone's own comfort at the GP, for their health literacy, their awareness, if they go in with an issue which you shut down with, you're too young for cancer, don't worry about it, that has a flow-on impact to patients, right? That has a flow-on impact. It has to. If you get shut down and the power dynamic is, no, sorry, love, you don't know what you're talking about, forget it. That has to have an impact on patients. And so I think as health professionals, we need to be aware of all of those components. But I think that we're also here to acknowledge that, you know, whenever I have a conversation with a GP or about a GP, they're kind of, there's a little bit of prickliness that happens.
Sure.
Because GPs have a lot on their plate.
Oh, yeah, that doesn't sum that up enough.
GPs have to know about everything.
Yeah.
Right?
Yep.
And GPs general practitioners are faced with an environment where the time pressure is massive, the financial imperative actually is there, and it really is complex, you know, the way that our Medicare schedule is constructed mm-hmm. and their ability to, you know, actually make a living is determined by all of these structures that are in place. But I feel like it's worthwhile calling out that just because that is the status quo doesn't mean that we need to then sort of accept that and move on when it's to the detriment of patient care and patient outcomes.
And I'm going to be a little bit sassy for a moment.
Do it.
Molly had cancer.
Yes.
Molly would have died.
Yeah.
If she wasn't the person that she was yep. and she didn't have the drive that she had to go, no, hang on a second. And I just want to let that just hang out for a second, because there are countless Mollies that don't have that.
Yeah.
And so if we're going to write off human lives to, oh, yes, buts,
mm-hmm.
like I got a real problem with that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think it's something that that we don't really understand.
No.
As going on in our system every
no,
day.
I don't. No. Overwhelmingly.
I think that takes care of the ranty component of this podcast. But I do want to add, I guess we wanted to get an advocacy perspective in response to Molly's story
yeah.
because I think that we want to point out that patient advocates, advocacy groups, patient organizations are a really essential component of the health system. And we just need to keep that in mind. I think Sarah gave us a lot of context mm. on both her personal experience and the experience of so many other patients with triple negative breast cancer and breast cancer in general. So I'm just, I'm grateful for that. And I feel like this is, and I feel like this was just a great opportunity to kind of, you know, shout out to advocates and yeah. advocacy groups.
Yeah, right there with you. Anyone, any group that's ever tooted their horn on behalf of a patient.
Yeah.
Shout out to you.
Absolutely.
And with that.
I want to thank Molly and I want to thank Sarah for joining us. I want to thank everyone for listening. And I really want to say, if you're loving our podcast, then get in touch and spread the word.
I would like to point out yep. to Molly and Sarah. Previous hosts have bought us cookies and donuts. No, previous call. Guests. We're the hosts.
I bought you nothing, and I'm pretty sure that's why Susanna had to buy you cookies and cakes. But anyway, it's a long story, people. But yeah, if you want to be on the podcast, shout out. If you want to buy us delicious pastries, also let us know. We do want to say, if you're loving the podcast, please, you know, review it, share it, like it. If you're not loving the podcast, please reflect on your own attitudes.
Yeah, because I think it needs an adjustment.
Yeah.
And we've brought you here to have this talk today.
That's right. Just bring some more positivity in future. And finally, you know, a little bit of a dropping ear, hinty, hint, hint about episode 4.
What have you got for us?
Well, it just is kind of coinciding with this kind of day that I was told that I was never going to see, which is the 5-year anniversary of my cancer diagnosis.
Oh.
Yeah. So I just thought, you know, maybe we'd talk about that.
Interesting.
A little bit.
Could be a bit of a coincidence. Can't even speak. I think we should wrap.
See ya.
See you in 2 weeks.